Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
I am the
Good morning, everybody, or good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are listening from. It is once again fantastic to have you here on the Petra Williams Show. Of course, I am your fiery enabler, and I'm here to educate, inspire, and connect you to live a rocking, awesome life. I trust that you enjoyed our last two phenomenal guests who both just had the most extraordinary story. And today, once again, I have another phenomenal woman who is going to rock your world. Her name, ladies and gentlemen, is Lisa Cox. Lisa, are you ready?
Hello.
To ignite?
Absolutely, Petra. Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Awesome. We're so energized. We're talking over each other. I love it. Well, Lisa is an author, a speaker, and a consultant who teaches women how to find fearless freedom and live with greater confidence, courage, and clarity. Now, this isn't just textbook theory. It's how Lisa lives her life, overcoming enormous health obstacles and now facing daily challenges with permanent physical disability. Lisa's mission is to motivate and empower you with substantial confidence, courage, and clarity. Wow, that sounds so epic, Lisa. I can't wait to share your story. So when you're looking at Lisa's photo, which you will see on the Blog Talk Radio, Coach on Fire Radio website and the Women on Fire website, she just looks like a normal woman, like another woman you walk down the street. Nothing different about her, and yet there is something very different about you. Tell us about yourself, Lisa.
Well, that's right. There's certainly a lot of differences, and yeah, from the chin up, I suppose everything looks fairly normal. But rather than walking down the street, I wheel down the street. So I'm in a wheelchair now, I suppose. But the backstory is, if I can just take you back, nearly 12 years. I'm coming up to my 12-year anniversary. When I was 24, I got a rare strain of a Streptococcus A virus, which caused a brain hemorrhage, like a stroke. So I was in a coma for 3 weeks, on life support for 2 months, and spent over a year in hospital the first time. During that time, I had lots and lots of operations, but the most significant, I suppose, were the amputation of my left leg, all of my toes, and 9 of my fingertips. I've had a heart surgery twice and a total hip replacement. So they're the really physical things that everyone can see. There's also a lot of what we call invisible disabilities going on, which is another reason why my photo looks all normal. But behind that, the scarring on my brain is permanent. I'm over 25% blind. My speech has been affected, as you can sometimes tell, and I'm really uncoordinated most days.
I'm uncoordinated and I haven't had a virus. So I'm sure the door frames jump into my way, honestly. So take us back a little bit, a little step. So how did this happen? So you said you had a career in media, is that right?
That's right. I was a copywriter in advertising, so absolutely loved my job. I got to write and I got to be creative and worked with some fantastic international clients working in some really big agencies around Australia. And then to lose all the tools of my trade, my fingertips, my eyesight and my brain was really quite devastating. So I've essentially had to reinvent and restart my life metaphorically and literally, I suppose, and now teaching or trying to teach women how to do something similar, how to overcome obstacles, maybe not as serious as mine, but just those little speed bumps we have in life.
Yeah, amazing. And so did this come about all of a sudden, or were you sick, or how did this, because I would imagine when you have a virus and that you are quite severely ill, and were you sick, or did it just come on suddenly? How did that happen?
Well, I'll end this with a little preface by saying that I have a bit of amnesia. Around the time that I had the brain hemorrhage, a few months before and a few months after, I actually have no recollection of what happened. So I'm going on reports from family and people in the area at the time. So I was at the airport one morning flying home to see my family when apparently before boarding the plane, I essentially collapsed. So they took me into hospital, ran a few tests, found out I had strep A, which had caused the brain hemorrhage, and to my knowledge, that's how it all unfolded.
Amazing. And how is it then that you lost your limbs? What was the reason for that?
Well, not being a doctor or having a medical background, my layman's explanation, I had complete organ failure. Complete organ failure when I was in intensive care, and the medication that they put me on for that was wonderful. It essentially saved my life. It brought all the blood back to my vital organs, which had all collapsed and shut down, but the blood was taken from my extremities. So all of my fingertips, my toes, my foot, even my nose turned black, and all of the black bits had to be amputated. But fortunately, I got to keep my nose.
But that's handy.
I know.
Wow, that's quite a story. And so when you sort of woke up, because you said you were in a coma for some time, when you woke up and you must have gotten the fright of your life, because all of a sudden you...
I did,
you were,
absolutely.
Yeah, you were fine 1 minute and in the next minute half your body's changed and you've lost some of your limbs. How did you feel about that?
I was very confused, slightly terrified, but when I came out of the coma, I don't actually remember coming out of the coma. My first recollection of being in hospital and retaining memories is maybe 3 or 4 months after it all happened. And by that stage, I'd already been in 3 different intensive care units and different hospitals. So I remember just being a little bit dumbfounded and thinking, what on earth has happened? Have I been hit by a car? Has something happened? Did somebody spike my drink when I was out? And very, very slowly, my family would sort of drip feed me bits and pieces of information. But remembering that I was on very, very strong painkillers at the time, all of my extremities were gangrenous and turning black, and I was on an awful lot of painkillers. Plus, I had a newly acquired brain injury, so my memory was just nothing. I really, really couldn't remember much at all. And one example of that is that my leg needed to be amputated below knee, and my family knew that for a long time. So one day they told me that my leg was going to be amputated, and as you do, I got really upset, cried my eyes out, and went to sleep. The next morning I woke up, had completely forgotten that they even told me, had no idea that my leg was going to be amputated, so they decided not to tell me every day, like Groundhog Day. And it was only a few months later that they finally told me. And at the time I was too weak to sit myself up in bed and have a look at my feet. So I had no idea I was turning black. I had no idea the horrible, horrible state they're in. It was only a few months later when I was told and actually remembered at that time.
Wow, that is phenomenal. That's incredible. That reminds me a little bit of that movie called 50 First Dates with, you remember, with Adam Sandler.
I know, yes. I know the one. My husband and I joke sometimes that being married to me is like 50 first dates, because I have the short-term memory of a goldfish and I'm always repeating myself to the poor man. And we do joke about that sometimes. I do remember our wedding day and some other important things, but remind him 5 times within a day to, you know, pick up milk or something like that.
Amazing, amazing. And so you had all of these things done to you and you lost your limbs. And wow, I would imagine that a lot of people, that could push a lot of people over the edge and say, I don't want to live anymore, you know, and really sort of get that mindset, well, you know, this, well, how am I going to deal with this? I don't want to be like this. And yet you pulled yourself out of it, and I would imagine the recovery would have been phenomenal. How did you deal with the mind games that I'm sure you would have gone through?
Oh gosh, how many hours do we have? Now that's a good question, but it was a lot of things. I had a lot of help from a lot of people, some really, really supportive family and friends, who I certainly can't take all the credit. At the same time though, in the back of my mind, I just knew that I really had no choice and no control. So having played so much sport, that was a really good learning tool for me. Having played so much sport in my previous years, knowing that no amount of sitting around and moping and feeling like shit is going to change anything. I knew there was nothing I could change, and I just had to get on with it. But I don't want to say everything was, you know, roses and beer and skittles is a bit of an Australian expression, but I don't want to pretend everything was great for a while. I had plenty of sad days, plenty of down days when I found out certain parts of my body were being amputated. I was very, very upset for a long period, but just knowing that there was nothing I could do to control it, and also this immense feeling of gratitude that, hey, things could have been so much worse, and knowing from stories my family told me that they had been so, so, so much worse in previous years. So one of the ways that I got around mind games was just to set myself little goals every day, really, really insignificant things. And each time I achieved one of those, I saw myself getting a little bit better. That gave me a bit of hope. There was some light at the end of the tunnel, and eventually I'd sort of move on and move up and get on with things. So it is permanent now. So every day I still have challenges, but every day I am still setting little goals to do little things. Last week I used a new piece of equipment at the gym. I've been there for 5 years and I finally did it, and that was a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome. And you, when we met originally, you were saying people see you at the gym, and they mm-hmm. often come up to you and go, wow, you're so brave. And how do you feel about that? Because how have you experienced other people's reactions to you, especially being somewhere like the gym, you know, where there are many, and I use this in inverted commas, able-bodied people who almost show you sympathy by saying, oh, you're so brave. How do you feel about that?
Peeve of mine personally, and I know a lot of disability advocates have written great pieces and said great things around this, but it drives me absolutely bonkers to be called brave just for going to the gym. I was a bit of a gym junkie prior to getting ill. The years and years and years that I went to the gym, played volleyball, trained with the Australian squad, rock climbed overseas, nobody ever called me brave. But now, just because I'm in a wheelchair, the going to the gym suddenly makes me brave, and that annoys me. If I was doing something brave, if I was a soldier or a police person or something like that, then absolutely call me brave, because they are brave people. But hey, I'm just going to the gym, it's no big deal.
Well, for some people it's a big deal. Not many people go to the gym full stop. So what do you think the reason is that they're calling you brave?
I can't be entirely sure. I know that it's meant to be kind, and it's meant in it's not meant to be nasty or anything like that. But again, it's something that a lot of disability advocates talk about. It's a point of frustration to be called inspirational, for example, for merely doing what, you know, for going to the grocery store. I was called brave for doing my grocery shopping the other day, and it really implies that I'm brave or inspirational just for being in public, just for getting out of bed. And yeah, there are some days I can't get out of bed, but that doesn't make me an inspiration. That doesn't make me brave.
Mm. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. Because we put such fear into our lives, and we put such obstacles and limiting beliefs in our lives when we see someone who we feel should be cowering in the corner somewhere doing something amazing. We immediately, I think some people may feel shown up by that. And so it's almost like they are appeasing their own insecurity by calling you brave. Do you think that that would be the case?
Possibly so, possibly. I know that a lot of what's said, not just to myself, but to other people, it's often a better reflection on that own person rather than whoever they're saying it to.
Yeah, amazing. So I found this very interesting, and this is, I think, going to it's a bit of a spicy topic. And you said that you met your husband after you lost your limbs and you are in a wheelchair now, which is so awesome. So tell me a little bit about how you met your husband and the fabulous dating stories you have.
So we have been married now for just over 3 years, but we've been together for just over 8. And for the first 2 years after I fell ill, I thought I don't need a man, don't particularly want to meet one either. I had much bigger priorities in my life, getting well, getting out of hospital, doing all sorts of things like that. And finally I sort of thought, you know what, wouldn't mind meeting someone one day. So I did go on a few horrible dates and met people through my gym, through just out and about, things like that. And yeah, it was the dating was really, really interesting, inverted commas, interesting, read, terrible.
Tell us about one awful date.
Oh, there were so many. What do I choose? One example of something that would happen. I can stand up from my wheelchair. I can stand up if I'm holding on to something. Can't really walk anywhere at all, but I can stand up. So I remember on one occasion I was out with my girlfriends and stood up at the bar with them and made eye contact with someone across the bar who I thought was all right. And was pretty happy. He started making his way over, and immediately I sat down in my wheelchair, as you do, because it was right behind me and I can't really move without it. And he came around the bar, saw me, looked down at the wheelchair, and then just made a beeline for the other side of the room. And little things like that, I suppose, happen all the time. People are more concerned about my disability than I am. It really doesn't bother me as much as it bothers other people, which I've always found really interesting.
And so you said that there is a certain type of person or certain type of man that likes dating women with disabilities. What was that about?
I wouldn't be entirely sure they liked dating women with disabilities, but a friend of mine did warn me about these, and she called them ambulance chasers. And it's a certain type of man who likes to perhaps date a woman who needs rescuing or needs saving or something like that. So I met a few ambulance chasers, unfortunately. My husband is definitely not one. Met a few ambulance chasers, and it, can I swear on this show?
Maybe not.
Okay, I won't. It was very frustrating. I don't need saving. I don't need rescuing. And certainly met a lot of ambulance chasers who, just because I was physically disabled, assumed that I wanted to be rescued or saved, which wasn't the case at all.
Yeah, it's amazing. So how did you and your husband finally come together? How did you sort of know that he was a keeper and that he was going to be a good fit for you?
He's definitely a keeper. I suppose I made it after, how old was I? In my late 20s when we got together. I knew by that stage, as many women would know, you have a much better idea of what you do and don't want in a relationship and in a partner. And I certainly had a much better idea of that. So there were so many things. We just clicked and we got each other. And actually, this is a bit of a strange diversion, but one of the first times I thought, this guy is absolutely fantastic, I was meeting his family at Christmas, and we're all sitting around at Christmas dinner, and there were prawns that needed peeling, and I thought, oh, I'd love to eat one of those, but geez, I can't even peel it, because with my hands, I can't even hold a pen, so peeling a prawn is really out of the question. And without even asking or anything, he just jumped up, peeled a prawn for me and put it on my plate. Little things like that. He's always doing wonderful little things that just make him an absolute keeper. So that was one of the many firsts.
I love that. You know, there are special times where you just know that person's amazing and the right fix for you when they do something amazing like that. I wonder then, what message do you have for women out there? Because there are so many wonderful single men and women out there that are lonely and say that there's no good men or women out there, and they make so many excuses. And what would your message be to those guys?
Be really clear on what you want, and don't ever give up on that. So just because I had acquired a lot of disabilities and look completely different, sounded completely different, my standards had never changed. I was still essentially the same person with the same sorts of values and wanted the same sorts of personality traits in a man. Just because I was disabled, I suppose that was the assumption that, or for a while, definitely not true, that maybe my standards would be low, but not at all.
How you make it sound so easy, Lisa. You make it sound so easy, like, oh, you know, I just went on these dates and there were these weirdos, and I was looked at a bit funny. Wow, you know, I find it phenomenal how, where did you get the strength and the courage and the grit from to continue to go out to a bar, like a bar in a wheelchair? Because, I mean, admittedly, most bars are not wheelchair friendly. Everyone's sort of standing around.
Right. Yep.
And when you wheel yourself in there, I would imagine that everyone's looking at you. So how do you get that courage and that grit to push through all the stairs?
No, you're exactly right. That a lot of places aren't wheelchair accessible, and I'm used to it now. That if I go into a room, everybody turns to look, and it's slightly frustrating. But hey, I'm different. If I had a big afro of green hair, then people would do the same thing. It's something different. But in one way, I just didn't care. I didn't give a, I can't swear, S-H-I-T, and a lot of self-talk in terms of really, really actionable steps that your listeners can take. A lot of self-talk just over and over again to myself, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. And it really did stick. So even today, people look and stare. It's just normal. My husband's used to it. My friends are all used to it. But it's just that not caring, I suppose, and having the confidence that you're much, much more than your external appearance.
And that self-talk, you said, is amazing. Self-talk and affirmation. And I suppose exactly like you were saying, instead of I don't care, it's like I'm so comfortable with who I am. And
exactly.
Yeah, that's a great one. So you, your mission is to empower people. Is it people or is it women in particular, or is it anyone on this beautiful earth?
I would like to say anyone on this beautiful earth. It's predominantly women, but I was speaking at an event just last month, and there are a few guys there as well, and many of the things I talk about, it's applicable to men or women, so it really doesn't matter. I do skew more towards women though, because hey, we girls get it. We know what it's like to have a bad hair day, or all the other things that that goes on with girls. The guys don't really get that as much.
Yeah, Absolutely. So your message is to be fearless. So how do you live fearlessly in your daily life?
Well, I know we chatted briefly about this before, and fearless for me is not bungee jumping and doing extreme things like that. Fearless for me tends to be far more subdued. So I suppose going to the gym at first, that was several years ago, maybe 10 years ago that I went back to the gym, and that was my first step in being fearless, knowing that I looked completely different. I really wasn't strong at all. I'm still not, but lifting very small weights and generally everyone just looking at me like, what are you doing here? So that was my first step to be fearless. But since then I've definitely moved on to that. Little things along the way, fearless, maybe walking down the aisle on my wedding day with my mum and dad on either side of me, wobbling all over the place, looking just a little bit ridiculous. But I know there's a big fuss around for women anyway. On your wedding day, what will you look like when you're walking down the aisle? I looked a bit silly, let's just say. And again, didn't really care, because that to me was fearless living, even though it probably seems quite insignificant to others. But every day I do a little bit of writing. I'm still a writer, and being fearless for me, I had to teach myself how to type again. So if I can get in a good hour of writing, that's my version of fearless. And some of your listeners might think that's not very fearless, but that's what it is for me. And everyone has to find their own version of being fearless. So perhaps it's sending that email or making that phone call that you're really afraid to make, or getting out of a toxic relationship, or whether it's with friend or family, something like that. So everyone's got a different version of fearless.
Absolutely. And we live in a society now that almost paints false heroes and says, if you're not like the Richard Bransons, the Oprahs, you haven't made it, and you're not fearless. And we live in a society that disrespects like stay-at-home mums and teachers, and because they haven't made the millions and they don't have such a high profile. And yet every person is precious, and everyone's version of fearless is different. And this is where I think a lot of this exactly like you were saying, and this is where I feel a lot of dissatisfaction comes in, because we constantly feel like we have to strive to skydive or bungee jump or to live a fearless life. But as you were saying, it is simply by breaking something, by doing something with fear. Feel the fear and do it anyway is the expression, isn't it? Exactly, and like you said, for you it's getting on a piece of gym equipment and typing or whatever it is for you. It is wonderful for other people too. So how would you recommend then that people start living a little bit more fearlessly? Because we do put, as we said before, so many barriers around ourselves and we create so much fear. Do you have a strategy that we can share with the listeners on how they could just start?
Really important to remember that fear is still okay. And I wrote up for the Huffington Post a few years ago about this. And being fearless is not about never, ever being afraid again and putting up this front that I'm invincible. So the example that I gave in a piece that I wrote a few months ago for the Huffington Post was that I was over in New York being fearless and fabulous and wheeling around New York, writing about fearless living, speaking about it. And then a couple of days later, unfortunately, I ended up in the emergency ward of a hospital over there. Everything's fine now. Everything was all right in the end. But at the time, I was absolutely terrified. I was crying my eyes out, snot everywhere. It was horrible. So I'd gone from being fearless and courageous and confident to being this blubbering mess. Now, that's just one example from my own life and is a bit extreme. But the point that I really want to stress is that it's okay to be a little bit vulnerable. It's okay to be afraid every now and again.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really valid point, because fear does have its fear and stress have its place in our lives. You know, it gives us that punch we need to push through, to where we need to go, to push out of our comfort zone. So they are real, and it's frivolous to deny those feelings. It is really important, though, to examine very closely what's triggering those feelings, and if that's real or if that's something of the past. And yeah, I'm with you there. We all have good days and bad days. Yeah, sometimes it's great just to wallow, isn't it? It's sometimes great just to wallow, eat heaps of chocolate, have a good cry.
Oh, for a little while, absolutely. You need
to feel
the fear, or you know, grieve, or whatever the case may be. But I speak to a lot of women and see a lot of women who maybe feel like failures because they've had a moment of weakness or a moment of vulnerability or something like that, and you're not being weak at all. You're just being human. It's perfectly normal and perfectly okay. But like I said before, it's just not making it a way of life.
Absolutely, and acknowledging those feelings. And when I did my diploma in life coaching, I really became very aware of my triggers and what's the stories that's causing the emotion. And I also understood, learned that each emotion has a purpose. And so you're absolutely right. Feel it for a little while, but never wallow in it. And if you do find yourself wallowing in negative feelings, go and get some help, because
exactly,
that's not
right.
Normal. Yeah. And,
yep.
You know, as women, we, once again, a very common misconception in society that women have to be strong all the time. And if you're crying, you know, you're weak, which is absolute rubbish. Because I'm sure you've shed a few tears in your lifetime, Lisa.
Oh, plenty. Absolutely plenty. And I will in the future. There's no denying that. Certainly not as many as I've shed in the past. But I think that's been part of being strong and confident and courageous today, was going through all the tears and all the bad days in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you do quite a bit of speaking for children. What is the main message you give to children of today, and how do they react to seeing you wheeling in the wheelchair?
I speak to especially young women a lot about media literacy and body image, because I had quite a bit of experience in media. I was an advertising copywriter for a number of years. So talking to them, one, about my own story and how you can still be confident and not look like everybody else. I definitely don't look like the models in the magazines, for example, but I'm okay with that. And I still love my body for what it can do rather than what it looks like. So aside from telling my own story, I speak to them about media literacy. And given that I had that background, talk to them about what we do with images before we put them in magazines, and how we edit things and how we edit images. So, for example, I showed them all a picture of me. And I said, what can you see here that has been edited or photoshopped or retouched? And I had someone photoshop on fingertips for me. So I look like I've got fingertips. And I said to them, you know, that was only a really small job, but if they can give me fingertips or a leg or take away some scars, imagine what can be done with a pimple or a freckle or a hair out of place, those sorts of things. So just giving young people the skills and the knowledge to make decisions for themselves.
That's so amazing. I once watched a documentary of photoshopping and how they took this model and they were looking at her photograph, which of course she was something like 15, and by the time they did the makeup, the lighting, etc., she looked 25, which is a phenomenal skill. Like, they're great artists. And they were saying, yep, oh, her neck's not quite long enough, let's elongate her neck. And so they just elongated it on the computer,
know.
You know. And they said, you know, her ears are a bit big, so they made her ears smaller. And so by the time the actual photo that was produced for the magazine, it looked absolutely nothing like her. It was just, she was sort of just like the outline that they sort of manipulated. And we tend to forget that, don't we, that everything we see in magazines has been changed. And yet
That's
we
exactly
still measure
right.
ourselves. Yeah, and so we still measure ourselves by that. How can we stop doing that, Lisa, do you think?
Look for worth and validation beyond external appearance. So I was fortunate in that before I fell ill, a lot of my worth was around my university or school or sports and those sorts of achievements. Like any 12-year-old, I put worth on the fact that I had no boobs and those sorts of things.
Yeah,
but
sure.
As I got older, I was fairly fortunate to put more worth in my skills as a writer or a sports person when I was playing more sports. So having my body disfigured in the way that it was probably didn't impact me as much. But that's one thing that I try to stress upon all women now, not just the young ones, that your worth is so much more than how much makeup you're wearing or what sort of clothes you're wearing or whatever somebody says on Facebook or Instagram or something like that. And beauty is not merely a hashtag or something you can download. I hate to use the word inner beauty because it sounds really cliche. So I wish I had a better word for that, but finding beauty that's not just about external appearances.
Well, you know what I really like to talk to women about, because I teach women to be unapologetically me. Yeah. And so
yes.
What I like to say is achieve stuff, do stuff. You know, your
yes.
results are a reflection of your character. And I often say, and one of the activities I do in my talks is I make women pull up their Facebook page. And I say,
yep.
Now let's look at your Facebook profile and let's look at how you're representing yourself and your personal brand. And most of them are just going, look, here I'm looking pretty here and here I'm looking pretty here. I said, which one of you actually has you doing something? Which one of you
yep.
actually has yep. you, like you, Lisa, climbing on the piece of gym equipment that you've been looking at for 5 months and eyeing out and discovering how you're doing it? Which one of you is actually achieving something? Because the thing that gives you confidence is results. The things
That's
that
right.
give you confidence is setting goals and achieving goals. And yet we
That's
want
right.
everything so easily. And because we have empty lives, we then measure ourselves by what other people say. And so that's what
True.
I loved about that. And that's what sport and arts, the arts and sports teach you, is engage in some activity that helps you grow exponentially as a person. And you will then become the person you need to become or want to become. And that person does not measure themselves by external factors, because we know what our abilities are. We keep growing. And that's where I think the one thing is really failing in society, is that we're not doing anything anymore. And so that's why we stop measuring, we compare ourselves and we get jealous, because we don't have anything in our own lives. And so what do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely, absolutely spot on. There's, and I'm generalizing here big time, but instead of maybe going out and about and playing sport, for example, younger people are, as a general rule, spending more time on social media. And there's a lot of evidence and research to support that. But growing up, I didn't have a Facebook account until I got out of hospital. I didn't even have a mobile phone. So I spent my afternoons walking around the local park and playing sport and things like that. And the only time I had to compare myself with other people, because we weren't allowed to read magazines at home and those sorts of things, which at the time I thought was horrible, but now I realize it was actually really good.
Yeah.
I compared myself with my friends, but as a general rule, the only time I would really compare myself was to the other volleyball players, who was the better player, or who could hit harder, hit the volleyball harder, for example, or who was performing better academically. So that was really one of the only ways I had to compare myself, because there wasn't a Facebook or an Instagram. Mm.
It's interesting. Is that comparison or is that healthy competition? you see, there's always good to have a bit of healthy competition than going, wow,
true,
that person's doing really great, I'm going to catch up to them. You know, that sort of it's healthy competition rather than comparison. I think there's a clear difference.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, you touched on social media. I'm interested too how we as a society like to blame social media for so many problems in our lives, and yet every day we have a choice to use social media.
Yes.
So what do you think? How do you feel about that?
I've spoken to people at different times about this, and to be honest, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with social media. I don't like to spend a lot of time on it, but at the same time, I realise it's really important for my work, and in some ways it's the only way to connect with other people overseas and whatnot. And as someone who can't leave the house independently and can't drive and can't get out and about as easily, it's a really good way for me to keep in touch with friends and other people. So I don't think there's anything wrong with social media. There have certainly been some enormous advantages to it. I follow news sites and read about things that I wouldn't otherwise have known about had I not subscribed or followed those particular accounts on social media. I think the problems start when we perhaps follow the wrong people, or we'll only post photos of ourselves that have been through 10 different filters and things like
that. Yeah, I really, it's never the tools, it's the person using the tools. So I think we really need to take some serious accountability. So absolutely, social media is it's a tool. That's exactly what it is. Yet people use it as an excuse and blame the tool and like put your phone down. You know, no one's forcing you. And it's, I mean, this is an endless discussion, and it really comes down to accountability. But we are coming to the end of the show. So I would love you to tell us, what is your final message to our listeners out there today? And tell us how we can connect with you.
My final message, so many to choose from, but if I had to pick one, it would be to find something small, start small, find something small to give you a little more confidence today, and then build on that tomorrow and the day after. So you're not going to do a complete 180 overnight and do everything properly tomorrow, but just start small. So maybe in terms of an actionable item, it could be something as simple as unfollowing a few toxic accounts, those accounts when you open your Facebook feed or your Instagram feed leave you feeling a bit flat or uninspired or a bit yuck. That's something really, really small and actionable that your listeners can do now. And then tomorrow, set yourself another small goal and do that and build on it every day. So in terms of getting in touch with me, my best contact is at my website, lisacox.co, and all of my social media links are there.
Excellent.
I spend a little bit of time on Instagram, a little bit of time on Facebook, on my Facebook page. I just posted this morning a link to the show, but I'll post a few other things up there. And Instagram, LinkedIn, those sorts of things. But like I said, I try not to spend too much time on there, but love interacting with readers and listeners. So would love to hear from anyone if they want to drop me an email as well.
Fabulous. So hop onto Lisa's website, because that's where you will find all the information, and also her information, all of her links will be on the show notes by the end of today. So hop on there too and connect with Lisa. Lisa's message is really powerful. Find out what your fearless is. Now, before we end the show, there was also an ebook that you really wanted to promote. Tell us about that.
That's exactly right. The ebook is called Find Your Fearless, and it's absolutely free. So I'm not trying to sell anything today, but just by subscribing on the website, Find Your Fearless will be sent to your inbox within a few minutes. And Find Your Fearless is 8 simple tips and strategies to find a fearless future. So like most of the work I do, it's not just based on academic theory and textbook theory. It's based on real life experiences, all of which are mine. So tried and tested methods to really learn to live this fearless lifestyle, things you can actionable things you can do, not just based on textbook theory.
Wonderful. So remember, guys, hop onto Lisa's website. What was that address again, Lisa?
LisaCox.co, LisaCox.co.
Yeah, LisaCox.co. Hop on there, give her your email address, and then download that fantastic book, Find Your Fearless, 8 Simple Steps to a Fearless Future. And that's where you learn all the amazing strategies that you can implement into your life to live more fearlessly. And as you know, this show is called Petra Williams, a Fiery Enabler, where we inspire, educate, and connect you so that you can live a phenomenal life. Thank you so much, Lisa, for your time today. We really appreciate your message, and we really look forward to seeing the phenomenal, fearless things you do in the future.
I look forward to it as well. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Petra. Really great to speak with your listeners.
Awesome. Well, guys, remember, you only have one life. Go and live it. And don't worry about what people say. Give them something to talk about, because most people live such mundane lives, they would love something to talk about. And make it your adventure and your amazing life, because you are all rock stars. Thank you again for listening wherever you are in the world. Have a fantastic day, and we'll see you next time. Ciao, ciao.
I can do anything, I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want, I can be what I want to be.
Radio.